And after another long week, we are ready to issue yet another edition of American Hit Radio. Today being Wednesday, the hump day, really. I've got some time to go. It feels like the end of a week for me because I'm going away.
Yay.
Well, boy, we're actually switching gears today. Myself, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales, Ryan.
When Wednesday becomes the double happy hour.
Yes, exactly, for us.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Heidi, as you know, for about 39 weeks now on our Wednesday program, we've been looking at what we were calling the best of the top 40, 500 albums that did make the top 40. And that came about as an answer to the original theme that we had about the alternative top 40.
Right.
Where we were doing 500 albums about the alternative top 40. We'd only gotten so far doing the alternatives. We got from 1964 up until about mid-1967 when it occurred, you know, we had the bright idea that maybe we should be putting some of the pop albums in, you know, the great pop albums in with that, which meant we had some catching up to do. So we went back to the year 1964, and we started all over again, this time with pop
albums.
With
parallel lines.
Right. So starting in January 1964, I believe we covered 39 albums, which got us up to very close to the point where we were with the alternative albums. So very soon we'll be able to unite and put them both together and run them chronologically without having to do this. You know, we'll let you know which one it is as on that day. But the one thing you can be sure of is that we'll be eventually moving in a chronological manner. Now, I'm saying all of this now because what is happening is in the course of putting this list together,
yes,
we're also more or less, you know, I'm writing a book basically on all of these albums that we're covering, with the emphasis for the book being on the albums that did not make the top 40. That's the
right.
Most important aspect of
not
it.
Not your father's top 40.
Right. So the past, what we've done for the past 39 weeks was really done for radio's sake, much more than for the book's sake. But they're great pop albums, and I think that they're important, and they deserve to at least be listed in the book as signposts for what
yes.
was happening in the real world, in the popular top 40 world, while these other more unusual or odd albums that didn't make the top 40 are the ones that we are going into detail about with our essays. So, saying that, for the past 39 weeks now, as we've been covering top 40 albums, I'm going over the book and I'm writing, and I realized that there were some things that I really should have included in the area.
You keep on finding your mistakes, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, you go over something again and again and again and again and again. It's what you do with writing. It's sort of like rewriting. And I realized that there were albums that I should have dropped in. So in the alternative album list between 1964 and 1967, if I was going to pick up exactly where we left off, we'd mm-hmm. be in March 1967 and everything would be hunky-dory.
Sure.
But
is that the album you're going to add?
Nope.
Okay.
That's already, that's 71 anyway.
Thought that was a clue.
71 anyway.
Okay.
But what I had decided to do is I realized that there were certain genres that I really wasn't giving sufficient attention to in its time, certain artists that I really think absolutely deserved mention that I wanted to add into the list. So I dropped in about another 10 or so albums in the alternative list that predate 1967.
Okay.
So if you're with me, logically what it is, what I'm doing now is I'm playing catch up by adding albums
right.
that were not part of my original list that now are. One of them, it would be the second album. So it basically jumps right in at the very, very, very beginning.
Wow.
I can't expect everybody to remember this, but the first album that we talked about in our alternative album list mm-hmm. was Muddy Waters, Folk Singer.
Right.
That was from early, I think January 1964 is when that Muddy Waters album came out. We did an entire show featuring that album, and I still love it. That's a great way to begin the book. I'm very happy. The second album that we did at that time was Jerry Lee Lewis Live at the Star Club, which came out in May 1964. Well, that now is no longer album number two. That's now going to become album number three in my book because album number two is being added today, officially with this show. And what I'm dropping in, I realized when I was writing it that I was not paying close enough attention to the jazz scene of its time. there were two reasons for that, to be specific. A lot of jazz in 1964 was becoming very difficult to listen to appreciate, and it more or less signaled the end of jazz. We did include a John Coltrane album. We included his most famous album, A Love Supreme, on our list. But when I looked back, I found an album that's not quite as well known that came out in early 1964, April 1964 to be exact, that is just a fabulous record. And I just felt like including just one Coltrane album from 1964 until his death, which happened, I believe, in late 1967, didn't seem fair, because at that point in time, Coltrane was at his most prolific period of his life. He was making so much music. He was working as a solo. I mean, before then, he spent so much time working as a sideman, for Miles, sideman for tons of other people. After he died, all of those recordings, he was so famous, all of those recordings eventually began to get credited. They'd re-release it under Coltrane's name because it would sell, because he became that popular. Which means that the albums that he was putting out around that point in time are truly fabulous records. Now, they vary between what you could consider to be like standard bop-style jazz or the much more extreme style of, say, the atonal stuff that was beginning to become very popular around 1964. There were a lot of people that were trying to push Coltrane in the direction of sticking to standard type jazz because they knew it would sell better. It wasn't as challenging. But Coltrane was very much a unique soul. Did what he wanted to do for the most part. Every now and then he would try to accommodate his label, and he would put out some albums that were relatively straightforward. Duke Ellington and John Coltrane, for example, or an album called Ballads. Where he would be able to go in a direction that that an untrained ear would be able to find acceptable. But then he'd push it a little bit further, and he'd end up with an album like A Love Supreme, which came out in 1965, won him two Grammy nominations, and became the best-selling record of his entire career. So by going against the grain, he actually achieved exactly what he wished to achieve anyway. Now, this album came out a year before A Love Supreme, and it really kind of balances on the head of a pin, dancing between the stuff that would be considered a little bit more acceptable and straightforward jazz and the stuff that would be considered freeform and maybe a little bit more challenging jazz. There's no doubt that A Love Supreme is a challenging album. So I would say that this is actually a little bit easier to appreciate. The name of the album is Coltrane Live at Birdland. Although the album is not entirely live, so the title is a bit of a misnomer. Partly live, partly studio. The reason I love it is that it basically gives you a cross-section of what made Coltrane great. There's an awful lot of different styles. There's just five tracks, and they vary a lot from one to another. And I think in some ways it might be perhaps the best place to start. If you don't know anything about John Coltrane, if you have no idea where to dive in, this is probably the album, because you're going to get to hear all of the different aspects of what made him great. Some of it challenging, some of it pretty easy to latch onto and hook that can pull you in. So let's start. The first track on the album, called Coltrane Live at Birdland, which, by the way, was released in April of 1964 and did not chart. Most jazz albums at this point in time really did not make the pop charts. So it's very easy for me to say that something this would include on any alternative list. But the opening track is Coltrane grabbing a song that had been written by Mongo Santa Maria and putting his own spin on it. It's about 10 minutes long, so hang in there. It's called Afro Blue. Thank you. Wow. Just an amazing track there, recorded live at Birdland. That's the title states, Coltrane Live at Birdland. An amazing.
Hard to believe that people can be so attuned to each other to play that well live.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. Coltrane's at the peak of his abilities on this recording. This is why
it's unbelievable.
I really recommend this as a great place to start if you want to get into him, because it is, as you can hear, it's gettable. And what you hear there is like really, really, really good, you know, ensemble playing.
Yes.
Stunning ensemble playing. You know, Coltrane's at the top of his game in stunning form. He's got that whole sheets of sound thing that the critic Ira Gittler phrased about his sound, and he's doing it perfect. But McCoy Tyner on piano is stunning, the way that he supports him. And the rhythm work of Jimmy Garrison on bass and Elvin Jones, the way that they support him, is incredible. It's just a four-piece band.
It's unbelievable.
It's just, you know, it's just them, and it's just so awesomely great the way that they pull it off. And you hear the stereo recording, too. I mean, it's very strict. Coltrane, if you don't get the left channel, you're not even going to hear John Coltrane on the record, because he's 100% in the left ear. Rather amazing. Well, like I said, now that's the track that I would say features the ensemble side of Coltrane's playing, which is one aspect. Now, every song on this album really portrays a different side of him. This next track is credited to Billy Eckstine as the songwriter. It's called I Want to Talk About You. And this is a much more mellow song. You could say this is a ballad, a very beautiful ballad. Now, Coltrane had released a studio version of the same song a couple of years earlier on an album called Soul Train. Here on the live version, he tries to, you know, retain that feeling of the ballad feeling, retain the beauty of the song. But as the band fades away at the end, Coltrane keeps going. And he plays a cadenza that is pretty much the last half of the song. So he plays literally like a solo saxophone for about 4 minutes, which could be outrageous. But what he manages to do is he holds on to the fact that it's a beautiful song. And he plays this incredible tag that just captures it perfectly, I think. So it's yet another side of what Coltrane is capable of doing. And again, a perfectly expressive piece that shows something really almost polar opposite of what we had just heard. Here is that track called I Want to Talk About You. Thank you.
Thank you.
Man, how I wish I had the opportunity to see that man live. This would have been something else.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Now, I don't know if this is true, but I heard it said that when in his younger years, he had been, this is true, that he started out as a alto sax player. What I'm not sure if it's true is that what it's been said that he heard Charlie Parker play, and he decided to abandon the alto sax, saying that
Parker, I'll never be that good or something, right?
Well, that's what he basically said. There's nothing left to do on that instrument. Because whatever could be done, he did it. So he decided to give up the alto and he moved to tenor sax. And then when he wanted to basically, you know, switch, he would go to soprano. So for one reason or another, that's whenever you hear John Coltrane, it's usually the tenor or the soprano sax. It's not the alto sax. He just stayed away from that middle instrument for his own reasons. But I mean, his style changed so radically over the course of his career. And what makes this album so incredible, I feel, is that it captures the various aspects of his career and the various styles of his playing. As we, you know, you could hear him already on those two tracks, moving from soprano to tenor, and the variety of the styles of the two songs. The next track also was recorded live at Birdland. I know the album is called Live at Birdland, but in point of fact, only the first three songs on the album were truly recorded live at Birdland. This, though, is a Coltrane original, showing yet another side of his style and of his personality. This is called The Promise.
Thank you.
That track is called The Promise. It represents the last of the three live sides on an album that is actually called Coltrane Live at Birdland. We're playing the entire album, mostly because, not only, yes, for its greatness, period. but it's also like what I consider to be like truly representative of just offering a great cross-section of Coltrane's career. And if you're into jazz, it's impossible, I feel, to appreciate the jazz in any real true sense without appreciating or at least learning to understand Coltrane. And since there's so many different sides to the man and styles that he's represented over time, this is just a great gateway album because it covers a lot of ground. Like you hear on that track, maybe a little bit of the Love Supreme style that he was going on. But here now on this next track is a studio song, and it represents some of the most intense aspect of Coltrane's personality and of his playing style. Now, nobody ever accused Coltrane of playing light jazz or being casual or playful. Free? Yes, he did play free jazz, but he was almost always deadly serious, especially when he was composing. And he wrote this song in direct reaction to when the news had come out about the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, that had killed a bunch of young girls, adolescent girls, who were going to the church for Sunday school. And some white supremacist set off a bomb and killed these girls, these young girls. And it was just such a horrific thing to hear on the news. And something that, of course, in the issue of in the Times, remember, this is 1964, exactly when politics were really, really beginning to change for the better, thank God. But in Birmingham, Alabama, this is the pushback that was happening. So Coltrane wrote this song in direct response to what was going through his mind when he heard the news about that bombing. The song is called Alabama. Thank you. a track that I feel captures the spiritual side of John Coltrane, the very emotional side, the sad side, his expressive talent on that song called Alabama. And there's one track left, and we've got some time. So what generally what I do with all of these, of course, like I said, is these albums are really excerpted from a book that we're writing called Alternative Top 40, 500 great albums that never did make the top 40. This album never charted at all on the pop charts. So I figured it'd be worthwhile for me to basically give my perspective on the record by reading that essay that's taken out of the book.
Cool.
Back in 1964, jazz music was not on the radar of youth culture. Unless you were born to the Marsalis family in New Orleans, chances are that the only jazz you heard growing up was on Saturday morning cartoons, or maybe Ed Sullivan or some other variety show. With the British invasion in full swing, jazz was rendered moot, even for a large percentage of the older populace. The sudden change in popular tastes certainly caused a great deal of resentment among the jazz cognoscenti. But what did they expect? The genre had evolved from the 40s pop music of swing to the much more elitist 50s bebop style, taking it so far away from populist taste that even most adults found it too demanding. And the generation of kids raised on rock and roll had no use for jazz at all. I was one of those British invasion kids, so jazz didn't seriously enter my consciousness until I was nearly 20 years old. By then, it seemed obvious that to appear well-rounded and intelligent, you needed to at least have a passing knowledge of jazz. So a few friends and I dabbled in albums by the genre's most lauded artists, like Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, and John Coltrane. Each of these artists had catalogs that were impossibly deep and complex, so we dug through discount bills and hoped to get lucky. Based on critical opinion, the must-have albums by Coltrane were A Love Supreme and Blue Train, and if you were especially adventurous, his Atlantic albums My Favorite Things and Giant Steps. All except A Love Supreme, by the way, were released before 1964, so they would never count in my book,
because
64 was my starting point.
Right.
To my young ears, these records sounded like gas music from Jupiter. The music was completely foreign to a generation raised on the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and the Monkees. So jazz records sat in my collection like strange anomalies, something played on Sunday morning while reading the New York Times.
But they made you look cool.
Right. It wasn't until I grew older that this music finally started to penetrate my cranium to the point where it could be understood and genuinely appreciated for its greatness. By then, I also realized that these artists had catalogs that went much, much deeper than the few releases held by populist critics. Slowly, I started to dabble with alleged obscurities and often found music that was by turns challenging and breathtaking. Late in my life, much later than I want to admit, I finally listened to Coltrane's Live at Birdland. Until that point, I avoided it, thinking it might have poor sound like the live Charlie Parker recordings. What a fool I was. The very first time I heard Live at Birdland, I knew it was special. But even then, I couldn't know that it would eventually become one of my all-time favorite albums. What makes it special to me is that it captures the multifaceted nature of Coltrane's greatness with phenomenal group interplay on Afro Blue. That is jazz quartet perfection, a stunning unaccompanied solo that conveys both passion and control simultaneously, his ending coda on I Want to Talk About You, which we had heard, and some of the most emotionally vested jazz music I'd ever heard. Alabama, an elegy to the four girls who were murdered during a church bombing in September of 1963, which can draw tears. The record never seemed to get its due from critical circles, and even the label, Impulse, seemed indifferent, mixing studio tracks in with live recordings and leaving poor edits on some tracks. It's enough to give the impression that this is just some slipshod release that was never given much thought by the artist. But the music speaks volumes beyond these superficial gaffes. If, like I once was, you are a novice trying to find a gateway to great jazz, I can hardly think of a better selection than Coltrane's Live at Birdland. Well, we've got one track left, so we'll end our show by playing it now. Just want to remind you, if you can, please tune in next week. Come back. If you do, you will hear us play one of the craziest albums that I will ever play on the air. It's a challenge.
Boy.
Tune in. We'll see you next Friday, I hope. Meanwhile, here's the last song from the album Coltrane Live at Birdland. This is called Your Lady. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.